From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we'll hear from one of the survivors of the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida.
Later, the little told story of the Milwaukee County Zoo's library.
People wander in because they see the sign on the door, and we're now on the zoo map, so they wander in and go, I didn't know the zoo had a library, and I explain the zoo's had a library since 1988. They often want to know, you know, if I have story time. Unfortunately, not.
Cartoonist and Milwaukee native Paul Noth says Charles Schulz his Peanuts was like the gateway drug for him and others in his generation.
I think it's pretty common among cartoonists of our generation because it was an entire world you could just get lost in. You know, it was like an epic novel, you know, and, you know, incredibly funny, very simple, too.
And we'll talk with legendary songwriter Jimmy Webb ahead of his Thursday performance at the Pabst Theater. Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Over the past weekend, more than 100 town hall-style meetings were scheduled around the country to engage lawmakers and constituents on the issue of gun violence in schools. The meetings were organized by many of the same people behind last month's March for Our Lives events in Washington and elsewhere.
Hundreds of thousands of people took part in the Washington, D.C. march, including survivors of the February 14th shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida.
The UW-Milwaukee Journalism Department took a group of 12 students on an immersion trip to cover the march and to gain hands-on reporting experience. Among them was Lauren Keene, who interviewed Randy Pacinani, a Stoneman Douglas student who survived the now infamous school shooting.
The night before the March for Our Lives, two Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School students were standing alone outside of the White House. 16-year-old Randy Pacinani and 18-year-old Juan Sanchez were holding a handmade sign that read, I came from Douglas to protest for my 17 friends who can't. On February 14, 2018, Randy was on the third floor of the high school's freshman building, hanging out with her best friends.
We were making Valentine's Day cards, and the next second, we're being shot at, literally dodging bullets. They turned off the lights on us, they cut the Wi-Fi, we were terrified.
The fire alarm went off, and Randy heard the sound of bullets echo throughout the hallway. She and 300 students pushed their way up a tiny staircase, trying to escape the 19-year-old shooter Nicholas Cruz. A student grabbed her and shoved her into a classroom for safety. He immediately locked the door.
He was chasing us up the stairs, and when I got pulled into the room, that's when he was there. So seconds after I got pulled into the room, and then he was trying to get into my door.
17 names were handwritten on the student's sign, including Alex, Kara, Gina, Helena, and her two best friends, Meadow and Joaquin.
Joaquin always had a smile on his face. He always was there for everyone. He always made everyone welcome. You might not know him, but he always came up to you, dabbed you up, asked you how your day was. Meadow, we called her Princess Meadow. I mean, that gives it away. She was the nicest person in the entire world. There was a kid in our class. She has a vocal issue, and Meadow would get up and read for every day. It was a creative writing class.
Randy also remembers the adult victims of the shooting.
Coach Vice, I park in the senior lot. We barely talked, but he'd wave to me every single day. He waved to everyone every single day. Coach Hickson, he was amazing. He was always there for the kids. If you ever were in trouble, you can go to him.
Randy says the first school shooting she remembers is Sandy Hook. She was only in sixth grade when 27 people were shot and killed at the Newtown, Connecticut Elementary School.
My class and I would talk about it in that period, and we were like, that person would never come to the third floor, obviously, but it actually did happen. And some of us, like me, I still don't believe it's real. I still think I'm going to be in class, and Meadow's going to be in there, and Joaquin's going to be in there.
Randy says the shooting was very traumatic, and she recalls her feelings of fear and anxiety.
Every day before school, even if I do go to school, sometimes I don't because I'm so scared, I kiss my mom goodbye and I hug her for at least 5 minutes and then I start to cry because I really think that's my last time seeing her. I didn't think I was going to make it out of there alive.
She's very grateful for her emotional support system, including her family, friends, and classmates.
I have nightmares every night. I couldn't eat for the first week. My friends never left my side. From the night it happens, they came to my house. And my family, I don't even know how to express my family. They've been by my side. And they're coming up tonight as well.
Many people wonder why the Stoneman Douglas High School shooting's media coverage has been different from previous mass shootings. Randy says she and her classmates made sure to document their experiences because they wanted people to understand their feelings of terror.
We have about 4,000 students in our school. A lot of us videotaped it, the entire thing. Emma Gonzalez is out there. She's a wonderful person. So is David Hogg. So is everyone else. Like Sandy Hook, they were so young. They didn't have social media. They didn't have phones, I guess. They were young, and I'm sure a lot of people did. But it happened so fast. But I guess we were stuck in there for so long. We got our phones out, and we wanted everyone to know. We just want this to stop. We don't want anyone to relive this.
She says the tragedy has brought her closer to her high school classmates.
A few days after it was felt like Broward was empty, like no one was around. But then when we started school up again and a few days before that, it's like we all came together. We're family, all of us. There's at least 4,000 kids in our school and we're all family.
Since the Stoneman Douglas shooting, Randy and her classmates have been extremely vocal about their strict anti-gun stance.
No one needs assault rifles. You really don't. They're made for killing people. Especially when you're 18, he was 19. Most 18, 19-year-olds are in school still. We're going to prom. You do not need that.
The students are especially passionate about making sure their voices are heard by politicians and other adults.
We might be from different zip codes, cities, states, but we're all here together. They can't silence us. We will come down, we will talk to everyone and make this possible because we are going to make a change.
Randy Pacinani survived the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida. Our story was produced by UW-Milwaukee journalism student Lauren Keene.
A quick break now, and then following last week's Bubbler Talk episode, we'll return to the Milwaukee County Zoo for an unlikely celebration of National Library Week. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Last week's Bubbler Talk episode answered a pressing question about the history of the Milwaukee County Zoo, specifically whether it was once legal to feed marshmallows to the bears there. It was.
But it was the person who helped us answer that question that opened our door to the next segment. Mary Kazmierczak is the information specialist for the Milwaukee County Zoo and the Zoological Society of Milwaukee. That means she keeps tabs on the zoo's history dating back to the time it resided at Washington Park. And she's in charge of the zoo's library.
If you are like most of us, you had no idea the library existed. And so, given that this is National Library Week, it seems like this is the ideal time to learn a little more about the library and about the Milwaukee County Zoo's history. Kazmierczak explained first what her job entails.
I provide regular library services to the zoo staff and members of the public who come in to use our library. Most of those are going to be university students or researchers who are here at the zoo doing research on the animals that we have. But I provide reference services. I do a lot of document delivery, that is getting articles and books and things that people want. I do research, lots of general library things that librarians would do at, you know, a law library or a corporate library. Not so much a school librarian, but general corporate business libraries.
Well, and this is where we're in the middle of the administration auxiliary inside the Northwestern Mutual Family Farm. And I don't know that a lot of people know that this library exists.
No, they don't. People wander in because they see the sign on the door, and we're now on the zoo map, so they wander in and go, I didn't know the zoo had a library, and I explain the zoo's had a library since 1988 and what we do, and I take them around and show them the books and the collection, and they often want to know, you know, if I have story time, unfortunately not for many people who come with strollers of children. We're a nice, quiet library. The library is designed to support the animal collection we have here at the zoo. So we have a lot of fun here, and we're open every year at the zoo's annual behind-the-scenes weekend, and people come in. In fact, I have a small following who show up every year to see what new stuff I bring out from the archives to put on the table and show people what we've got.
And how long have you done this?
I have been here 12 years.
Did you know there was a library here before you took this job?
Yes, because I was a Zoo Pride volunteer and worked in the library. So I am the poster child for serendipitous job search. When I finished my master's in library science at UWM in 2005, the contract librarian decided she didn't want the job anymore. And they said, oh, would you like the job? And I said, yes, because first of all, I was unemployed. But secondly, I knew the library and I'd already been doing a lot of work and sort of modernizing the library. So
I'll confess, the first thing that I thought of when I found out that the zoo had a librarian was that you would check out books to the animals.
That would be fun. We have noticed that bonobos, especially the small bonobos, are very interested in when people have books. And in fact, must be more than 10 years ago now, when we had a book written about our bonobos. I was a Zoo Pride volunteer paging through the photos in the book, and the little bonobos were there looking at and were saying when to move the page. So
I'm imagining, though, the bonobos would have a real hard time with, like, overdue fines.
Yes. I'm not quite sure I'd want a fine that came from a bonobo, because gosh knows where it came from.
So you mentioned, we mentioned the Washington Park version of the Milwaukee County Zoo. The zoo obviously has moved to its current place. How long was it at Washington Park, and why was the move such an important part of the zoo's history?
The zoo started at Washington Park in 1892, and it was there until this zoo opened in 1961. It was a 23-acre zoo at Washington Park, and when the zoo was created, it started out as a deer park and gradually grew. When the zoo was founded in 1892, Washington Park was in the middle of nowhere. By the 1930s, the city had grown up around it. There was no ability to expand into Washington Park because of the amenities of Washington Park. And the Zoological Society wanted to move the zoo. They wanted to improve the zoo, to make it a bigger, better zoo. Couldn't do that in Washington Park, so it needed to move. What ultimately brought the zoo to this location was the building of the stadium freeway, which took out the bear dens. And so that's what really was the final straw that resulted in the zoo moving to this location. And when this zoo was built, it was out in the middle of nowhere and before the freeway came in. So the zoo is now hemmed in by the city and the freeway as well.
So as we're having this conversation, there is a nice tie between the zoo's history and the history of, say, the Milwaukee Braves or the Milwaukee Brewers, because without the stadium freeway, perhaps it would have stayed at Washington Park for longer.
It might have. By the time you got to the 1940s, the Depression and World War II had meant that there wasn't a lot of infrastructure improvement at the zoo. So even by then, the buildings were becoming more dilapidated, and there would have been a lot of cost to renovate the zoo to keep up with the times. So if it hadn't moved here, you know, there's no clear evidence that the zoo would have continued to be a important cultural amenity in the city of Milwaukee.
When did the move actually happen?
The move happened between 1958 and 1963. As buildings were built at the zoo, animals moved from Washington Park to here. The last ones were sent over in 1963. So for a while, the zoo was operating in two locations. You had the Milwaukee County Zoo, which opened in May 1961. In fact, Mother's Day, 1961. And then finally in 1963, all of the exhibits at the Washington Park Zoo were closed, and then it was deconstructed.
Mary Kazmierczak is the information specialist for the Milwaukee County Zoo and the Zoological Society of Milwaukee. She is also featured in last week's Bubbler Talk, which you can hear at WUWM.com.
Milwaukee native Paul Noth draws cartoons for The New Yorker, but his latest project targets a much younger audience. We'll speak with him when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Milwaukee native, cartoonist, animator, and author Paul Noth has reached a lot of different audiences in his career, from TV viewers of Conan O'Brien and Saturday Night Live to erudite print readers in the pages of The New Yorker and The Wall Street Journal, and now discerning middle grade readers.
Noth's new book is the first in a trilogy. It is called How to Sell Your Family to the Aliens. Noth is back in Wisconsin this week for a series of school visits, but he joined us in the studio as well. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about your career path. How did you go? I gather you are a product of MPS?
Yes, I'm K through 12, MPS schools the entire time. I just visited my high school. I'm coming directly from there, from Rufus King High. Always interested in cartoons. That was a distraction. That wasn't actually my studies. I didn't think that I would, luck out enough to get to do that for a living. Loved writing, too. Loved books and literature, and thinking I'd be a writer, I went to Emerson College in Boston after King, and there I pursued literary fiction for a while, but always loved to draw, and drew in my spare time, filled up notebooks with my cartoons.
What were the cartoons you were reading when you were young?
I loved Calvin and Hobbes. I loved Charles Schulz, Peanuts. I really had everything. I would scour every public library for every cartoon. Anything that was a cartoon, I was familiar with. My father, who was the film critic for the Journal and feature editor, he'd bring me home sometimes. Cartoon books would come across the feature desk, and he'd bring them home for me. And that was a great era for cartoon books. So I was familiar with The New Yorker. I was familiar with, it was a much bigger field in those days of all the newspaper comics and stuff like that. And so, but my favorite was probably Charles Schulz, and then a little bit later, Calvin and Hobbes.
It's interesting. I remember interviewing Mo Willems years ago, and he talked about getting into cartooning thanks to Charles Schulz. And his thought was, thank heavens that Peanuts was so relatively simple to draw, because he could draw his version of peanut strips when he was in fourth grade.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. I was doing third grade is exactly right. I was copying Peanuts and trying to perfect them. That's another thing. I know Mo, and that's another thing that we have in common is that I didn't realize that. But I think it's pretty common among cartoonists of our generation because it was an entire world you could just get lost in. It was like an epic novel, incredibly funny, very simple, too.
You mentioned the idea that you were just in this, the world of cartoons was huge in those days. And I don't know exactly how old you are, but it seems like about the same era that I grew up in. When you go to a school today, you just came from Rufus King, you're going to Trowbridge in a little while, you're going to spend the day on Tuesday going to schools in Oconomowoc. Do you see, are kids immersed in cartoons the same way today that they were when you were a kid?
I think so. It's a different world. It's a digital world. My question for them is not, have you heard of The New Yorker magazine? It's, have you heard of magazines? There is a whole world of online cartoons, and a lot of what they think of as cartoons is animation, because that's much big. I loved animation as a kid, but it was few and far between. You had to get up on Saturday morning. You had to get you had to let your mom turn on the TV after school to watch Bugs Bunny, which was really my favorite thing in the universe, were those Bugs Bunny cartoons. Animation is much more widespread, but it's looking at my nieces and nephews, it's amazing how popular comics are right now, like comic books, anime. What isn't, my favorite thing as a kid was the sort of short joke form. And that is, while it's, in corners of the web, there's very good work being done. That's not as big as it was. But, comics are huge, and anime is just huge, So it's out there, just sort of in a slightly different form.
And I feel like I cut you off in your description of your career path, because the last we heard, you were working in literary fiction.
Yes.
And and then somehow you went from drawing in notebooks to actually doing it for a living.
Yeah, that was very surprising to me, because I was, I was aware of The New Yorker from a very early age, and I sort of wrote it off at that early age, too, because I knew I watched it and I paid attention, and I knew not just by reputation, but I saw, you know, that it was always the same people, you know, and that it was really hard to break in. And so I never thought I would be a New Yorker cartoonist. And I was living in New York, and I began writing comedy. And there was a comedy show in New York called The Rejection Show. And it's everyone takes their rejected material and, you know, that you perform it or you show it. And so it was at that comedy show that I met Matt Diffie, a New Yorker cartoonist. And I showed him some of my cartoons. And he was like, you know, we're trying to bring in new people. It's, you know, it's Bob Mankoff, when he took over as editor, he was like, this art form is not going to survive unless we bring in more. So, you know, now, you know, under Bob, it was, you know, you started to see about 10 new people every year, whereas before I felt like it was like 10 new people every decade, you know. So that gave me my chance. And Matt sort of looked at my stuff and gave me feedback and said what Bob would hate and why. So he taught me how to do the weekly batches, 10 cartoons a week. And, you know, if you have the best week ever, you will sell one, you know. So they're probably all going to get rejected. Then they invited me to come to the Tuesday Look meeting, you know, and that was the beginning of it for me.
What was the first one that was accepted of yours?
The first one, I really lucked out because I sold for my first batch, which is really unusual. And it was right during the Iraq War. And it was a White House press secretary, and he's holding a flashlight under his face. Like a kid, like a campsite, and the press person is saying, "How do you respond to critics who say you're just trying to scare people?" and so I really, you know, that I was not expecting to sell from my first batch, and so you know, and I was off and running, and getting that validation from the New Yorker, you know, I was hooked.
I've interviewed a number of people who, you know, draw regular comic strips, and we've talked about, you know, sort of how far in advance they're submitted and how the editorial process works. But how does the process work for the New Yorker even after they've accepted a panel, which I gather has to be a lot more, you know, rapid turnaround than what somebody drawing 3 months in advance for a strip that's going to run in the newspaper will be?
Well, you know, sometimes they want it immediately. You know, and we're sending in roughs. We're sending in what's suggested is 10 roughs a week, different ideas. And sometimes they're topical and they want them right away. And sometimes some of them are supposed to be evergreen and timeless.
The How's Waldo one, for example.
Yeah, as long as Waldo's around, you know, that one might work. So it all depends. And so I will do, you know, sometimes I'll take a week to get it in. Sometimes I'll have to turn it around overnight, you know.
And how much editorial guidance are you getting?
Yeah, you know, not that much. Especially when Bob was editor, and even now with Emma Allen as the new editor, he was a very big believer in letting us find our own voice and our own sensibility. And he thought that he would give us advice that was, you know, his ethic was find your own voice, find your own way to do this. So, you know, which is great, but his advice would be sort of maddeningly vague because of that. Like, keep working on this, you know, keep working on the art. This is just okay, you know. And it was a great mixture of encouragement and just, you know, like cold-hearted rejection at the same time.
Just kind of like life, really.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Bob Mankoff is a lot like life.
How often do you go to the Tuesday Look meetings?
You know, I haven't been in a while. I really went when Bob was sort of getting to know me and the magazine was getting to know me. And I think that's when it was important to go. And I could kind of feel him out and get a sense of what he liked that I was doing and what, you know. And he was sort of my champion there. He spotted something, you know, in my cartoons early on. And, like, he really encouraged me. But over time, you know, I start to wonder, you know, they like my cartoons. Me showing up in person, I could just mess it up, you know. So, you know, I began doing more just emailing, you know, after a while. But I drop in when I can and see, you know, it's a sort of, you know, a group of cartoonists there. It's a great sort of, it's great to complain with people who have to, you know, go through the same thing you do.
What sparked the move to middle grade fiction?
You know, I was interested in doing something like that for a while. I grew up loving Roald Dahl. And I always kind of wanted, I was thinking like something along those lines. And, you know, I work a lot in notebooks and I kind of work stream of consciously. I'm not sure if something's going to be a single panel cartoon or an idea for an animated piece or an idea for something longer. And it was in a notebook, How to Sell Your Family to the Aliens. And I forgot when I even wrote that. And I just, in front of it, I drew the kid counting money. And then I wrote the first line, which was, before you assume I'm a bad person, you should know that I had originally only planned on selling my grandma to the aliens, not my whole family. And I liked that voice, you know. And then it just sort of sat there. And then through my work in The New Yorker, I was contacted by an agent who said, do you have anything for middle graders? And I said, maybe. And so I just sort of picked that up again and wrote a couple chapters. And I sent it to her, and she became my agent and said, finish this. And, you know, and then she's sort of guided the process ever since.
And thus Hap Conklin Jr. was born.
Yes, exactly. That's the birth of Hap Conklin Jr.
There is something about an audience that reads a book and then rereads a book and then reads it a third time and a fourth time and then has their parents say, do you not have other books?
Yeah.
It's not like that with, I mean, you know, I might look at a New Yorker cartoon and find it funny and then show it to my wife who also finds it funny, but that's probably where I leave it.
Yes. Yeah, I think that, you know, there's something about that when, you know, when a kid attaches to a story, you know, that becomes the story and they want to see it again and again and again. And I remember stories like that from when I was a kid and, you know, and it becomes very important. You know, and so that's why it's really, you know, seeing all these kids responding to the book really just blows my mind. You know?
I was going to ask about that because you probably don't get the same kind of feedback. You know, you probably get a lot of complaining feedback sometimes on a New Yorker cartoon. But
yes.
You go to a school and they have devoured this book. And
yes.
The feedback is a little different.
Yeah, that was, you know, and to see the kids welcoming me. I was in Chicago schools or Chicago area schools all last week, and I was welcomed with huge, amazing artwork of the characters, of, you know, of aliens, of, and they were, you know, and it was, it, that kind of blew my mind, you know, it was, it just to see them, you know, to see that it got their imagination going, and them, and, you know, and they pick right up on the humor, they pick right up on the characters, and, yeah, so that was fantastic.
What do you think they look for when you go to an event like that? What do they take from you?
I think that it's it's a wide mix of students, you know, and everyone is different, you know, so it's a little bit of a new world for me because I'm kind of used to just sort of spinning this stuff off in my own mind and in my own studio, and then I'm in front of some schools it's third through fifth, some schools it's just fifth, some like sixth graders, and it's all sort of wildly different, but you know, I love that they are laughing. You know, that I think is key. I think about myself when I was that age when I'm writing this, and I think about, you know, when it started, I love science fiction. So I think about myself now and I think about, you know, what I want to read now, but then I remind myself, hey, you know, 9-year-old Paul wants to read Mad Magazine, you know, and so then I kind of try to bring it back there. And so it's sort of just the mixture of that. And different kids are really responding to different things from the book.
Visiting a high school a little different because they're obviously older than the target demographic for the book, but it must be nice to connect with like the school you went to.
Absolutely.
I didn't want to date it, but
yeah, it was way back when.
It's still
yeah.
standing.
It's still there. Yeah, it's still there. And I'm still standing too, barely. And the yeah, there was I was talking to art students and writing students. And so, you know, it sort of was a chance for me to, you know, to talk to that age version of myself and tell them, you know, and sort of talk about my journey through, you know, through the different arts and doing animation and doing writing and doing art and trying so many different things and seeing what connected and seeing, you know, and it was in the same room, actually. I realized once I was giving the talk, it was in the same room where Rufus King has the International Baccalaureate IB program. And it was in the room where I took my IB art exam. And they had all their artwork up, you know. And so I could go after the talk. I went around and I spoke with them about, you know. And it's just really, it was so good to see because there's so, you know, there's so much amazing work going on there. And it's... you know, and it was very inspiring, and I hope I sort of gave them a sense of what, you know, of first of all that this is possible, that you can go on from, you know, you can be from an MPS school and, you know, you can go on and have, you know, your work appreciated. And also that it was difficult, you know. And so I feel like I really it was actually a really great time.
When you think about cartooning and doing animation, which you have done, and writing middle grade fiction with illustrations as well, we should say, do they all occupy a slightly different place in your creative life? Do they scratch a slightly different creative itch for you?
I think so. Yes, it's and one of them, you know, lately I'm writing these books. It's a series of three books, and this is the first, and I'm finished the second, and I'm revising it, and I'm thinking about the third. And it is, I mean, writing stories has always been tremendously fun for me. And it's a sort of a different kind of manic energy. And there's all of a sudden, I just want to see what the characters are going to do. I want to see what's going to happen, you know? Single panel joke cartoons are fun, but they're difficult. You know, they're difficult in a different way because they're like a marathon versus a standing long jump. You know, like you just have to do it. And you give yourself some prompts, but it's really just, you know, it's really just you and that piece of paper, and you can't, you know, there's no characters to sort of build energy and have it sustain itself. But, you know, when you get it right, when you get a good one, you know, that's very addictive. That's really fun. So,
well, right. The thing that always strikes me about those single panel strips is that the really good ones, as you look at them, you can kind of, you know, it's incumbent on you to be able to figure out what has just happened before and what the result might be afterwards. You're kind of freezing this funny moment in time.
Yes, and I think the best ones kind of open up a world, you know, and they're surprising because you don't expect something that small to be funny and to resonate like that, you know. So it's because of the limitations of the form and the fact that people are just jumping into them and jumping out of them. You know, they're reading in the New Yorker, it could be they're reading something about, you know, China's economy, and then, you know, they're jumping into your, you know, you have two guys in a bar, and you know, that's the context, you know. So it's you know, they're very challenging, but they're extremely fun. And I've always been like a huge fan. You know, whenever I see a really good one, it just makes me happy in like a very particular way.
Well, Paul Noh, thank you so much for spending some time with us. And best of luck. Hope we'll see you again with book two.
Oh, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
Milwaukee native Paul Noh is a cartoonist whose work regularly appears in The New Yorker. His new book, however, is for middle grade readers, though. It's called How to Sell Your Family to the Aliens. He's in Wisconsin this week for Milwaukee and Oconomowoc school visits organized by Boswell Books and Books & Company.
We will take one last break and then talk with legendary songwriter and performer Jimmy Webb ahead of his Thursday concert here at the Pabst. Lake Effect continues in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tite.
I am a lineman for the county.
Glenn Campbell made Wichita Lineman famous in 1969, and his recording of it made 19-year-old Jimmy Webb famous, too. The catalog of songs Webb went on to write has in many ways defined American pop music for the past five decades.
From Galveston to All I Know to If These Walls Could Speak, Webb's songs have been covered by many in the pop and rock pantheon. And since the early 90s, Webb has been on the road himself performing his own songs in his own way.
Webb will play at the Pabst Theater on Thursday evening. We had a chance to catch up with him on the phone before that, and he told us where his songs began.
You know, I'm the son of a Baptist minister, and my mother's fondest, wildest dream really was that I would eventually become the pianist at the First Baptist Church, which she perceived as the very pinnacle of show business success. So from age six, I had a very thorough instruction in John Thompson's first, second, third grade piano books. By the time I was 12, I was on the piano bench in the First Baptist Church. And being 12, 13, and 14, the hormones began to run wild. And I suddenly found out that I not only loved music, because up until then I had not been sure, but I found out that I not only loved music, but that the girls in my class loved music, too. And I started actually imitating the songs that I heard on the radio. In those days, we had what's called a follow-up, so a group like Little Anthony and the Imperials would have a song like Hurt So Bad, and then they would follow it up with I Think I'm Going Out of My Head. And I was able to gauge how successfully I was, you know, approximating what might be what we called a follow-up record for all the artists. And this was an exercise that I developed on my own. And at a certain point, I thought, you know, I could really be a songwriter. Now, this is just a conclusion I came to on my own. And, of course, it's hardly necessary to say that my father, the minister, was not crazy about this idea.
Or your mother?
Well, no. You know, for a very short time, she had to worry about that. But unfortunately, my mother passed when I was 16 years old.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I appreciate your condolences, but believe me, it's at this point, that's an old story. She was young. She's quite beautiful. The family really just orbited around her. And so when she left us, my father and a bunch of the kids went back to Oklahoma. We were in California. I stayed because we were in San Bernardino, and I knew that Glenn Campbell lived in Hollywood somewhere. And I was only an hour away from Glenn Campbell, and, you know, there was no way I was going to go any other direction than towards him.
Well, and that is one of the great musical collaborations of American songwriting and performing, you and Glenn Campbell. I mean, his voice is indelibly linked to so many of your songs, Wichita Lineman, By the Time I Get to Phoenix, Galveston. I mean, I was just re-listening to Galveston before I came in the studio, and it breaks my heart.
Well, Glenn had a kind of plaintive quality, a resonance in his voice. He didn't always use it, but on certain songs, he would sort of use this almost a cry in his singing voice that was really one of the distinctive parts of his style, and it seemed to fit these sad songs pretty well. I know that when I was actually connected with Glenn, and that was through another singer called Johnny Rivers, who knew him and had made a record with him. When we were connected, it seemed like all of a sudden, I don't want to be too sentimental about this, but it seemed as though we sort of completed each other in some way. And I like to sing. I like to perform. But I'm no Glenn Campbell. And Glenn was fascinated with songwriting, but didn't write a lot of songs and wasn't really involved in that side of things. He had great ears, and he could hear things that no one else could hear. It was a wonderful arranger, for instance, which he doesn't get credit for. And as you probably know, he had played on thousands of hits. So he had a background of this unparalleled, really, depth to what he could bring to a record, a recording session. So we sort of reached critical mass there in Hollywood in 1967, and he and I came together with his incredible backlog of experience and my inexperience, my utter, you know, almost pathetic teenage angst, you know, and boom, you know, we had quite a case of success there for a while.
Yeah, I was going to say, to use a phrase that's been coined a lot, you made beautiful music together.
Oh, you know what? I love it that you said that. I love it. You know, that saying or that axiom really, really comes into its full meaning when you apply it to Glenn and myself, because I miss him now, and it's not something that I'm going to dwell on while we're here on the air together, but you know, there's a big musical part of me that's gone, because Glenn would do things like stand behind me and watch me play the piano. And he could make the same noises come out of the guitar that I was making on the piano. And the piano and the guitar are like two instruments that don't really like each other very much. And the fact that he was able to create those voicings by just watching me play and by listening, it put us in the same musical world where politics, where we were hopelessly divided. He loved Bob Hope and he loved John Wayne, and he was really an Orange County Republican, and he played golf, and I hated golf. And I was to the left, definitely to the left, and wanted to be perceived as a member of my own generation, which included Harry Nilsson and Warren Zevon and Randy Newman and all these guys. And yet, I was never so comfortable musically as when I was in Glenn's company. He really was a musical genius.
Well, and you hear that. When you two recorded together, when you listen to him, you listen to the arrangements, and, you know, for me, it's like he most fully speaks your songs, your music. I mean, I've heard lots of other people do your stuff, and they've done beautiful arrangements of them, but he somehow seemed to get you.
He got me. He got me. He got the chords. You know, there's a joke going around Nashville. There's a saying down there about country music that it's just three chords and the truth. And they say, except for Jimmy Webb, he's 12 chords and the truth. You know, but Glenn got the chords. He loved chords. He loved the musicality of my writing. And how lucky was I, Bonnie, to find this guy? And you know, the sense of loss is, you know, it's profound. But, you know, he faced his illness and really all the challenges of life with such a, you know, unmitigated enthusiasm and will to triumph over whatever obstacle was put in front of him.
There was such a dignity about him, I found, even when, you know, when he was younger. And, you know, in his full steam, there was just this sort of aura of dignity I always felt about
him. I learned a lot from him because I was a kind of raw kid. And when I got to L.A., I was off the leash there for a while. I mean, I had a lot of money and a lot of spare time, you know. And in a way, he would, you know, pull on my leash every once in a while and say, you know, you didn't have to do that or... You know, he believed in speaking plainly. He didn't believe in jiving anyone around, which was very unusual in Hollywood, I have to say. And I live in the East, and I'm not down on it. Listen, I had the California dream. I mean, I had it. I loved it. I loved everything about California, and it gave me everything it had to give. And so there's a love affair there that will never ever go away, but there was a decidedly a lack of directness in business matters and projects that just went on for ages and ages and ages until they sort of like died of exhaustion. It was not an East Coast way, or even a Northern United States way of doing business. It was a kind of, I call it the manana syndrome, you know. And he was, on the other hand, very deadly serious about getting things done, getting them done on time. I remember when he called me one afternoon from the studio and said, I need a follow-up for By the Time I Get to Phoenix. Can you write it for me? And I said, now? And he said, well, we're in the studio. And I said, well, okay. And I started writing, and you don't really get any awards in songwriting for how fast you write a song, but by 5 or 6 that afternoon, I had written Wichita Lineman, even though it wasn't finished, and I sent it over to the studio to Al DeLore and Glenn, I think Gold Star, one of those places, Western. Didn't hear anything about it for a couple of weeks, and ran into Glenn just somewhere, it seems like it was out on the street in front of a record company, and said, oh, hey, I guess you guys didn't really like Wichita Lineman, huh? You know, songwriters are used to think it's no big deal when somebody turns down your song. You take it in stride. And he said, oh, you mean Wichita Lineman? And I said, yeah. He said, we cut that. And I said, you did? I said, well, you know, it wasn't finished, Glenn. And he said, it is now.
So you, Wichita Lineman, what we know as that song, as far as you were concerned at the time, it wasn't done.
I thought maybe it needed another verse. But they were calling me every 15 minutes and asking me if it was done yet. And so finally I just kind of, in a fit of frustration, I sent it over there because I had 2 verses. So they took it, and when you hear it now, you'll hear him play that big guitar solo with that Duane Eddy sound. And they just filled up the hole and put it on the record.
And a classic was born, my goodness.
Well, you know, it really was, and now you wouldn't quite know what to do with the song if there was any more to it. It certainly didn't need anything else. And I think that's what Glenn contributed to me. In many cases, I would have taken it another step and ruined the whole thing. And he just had, as you say, a kind of reticence, a dignity about his playing and his music. He didn't think it needed any more words, and he cut it.
And he was right.
Yes, he was.
You're out performing. Like you say, you love to perform. You've been out on tour. You're coming here. What is it like for you to perform these songs that are yours but are inextricably linked to someone like Glenn or to someone else who covered it?
Well, Artie Garfunkel, for instance, mm-hmm. who's All I Know, and it was his first release after the big breakup with Simon and Garfunkel. And so there was a lot of pressure on that moment. But the truth is, to answer the question, is if I think about what I'm doing, which is I'm sitting on a stage and I'm singing this song that Glenn Campbell recorded, and he's not here anymore, but the song is still here and I'm still here. If I actually think about it, I think I would break down and cry. And so when I'm performing, I'm performing. It's a different state. It's a mental state. It's an alpha state where you go out and you concentrate, and most performers, I think, would agree with me, you really concentrate on the material and getting each song across as well as you can with the gifts that God has given you. And within those boundaries, there's a safe place on stage where you're not really very emotional about what's going on. However emotional the audience may be, and sometimes they'll be sobbing and crying, and I'm aware that they're doing it, which is why a lot of the times I'm joking around on stage. I mean, there's a lot of laughter. I don't want to leave the wrong impression. It's not like a wake, but you create a sort of a magic circle to perform in. But every once in a while, an errant thought will be, you know, I remember that day that Glenn and I went over to Manuel's and we both bought rhinestone cowboy jackets, you know? And that thought will be there, and all of a sudden my voice will start shaking and I will have to make an effort to sing through that and actually not sob or cry during the performance. That's just not professional. And I think that if some people saw you doing that, they might misunderstand and say that, you know, you're acting, that you're really pouring on the, you know, the schmaltz. So sometimes I think it's kind of a delicate balance of getting too involved with your own material. I don't think it's as difficult for pure singers who do a lot of repertoire by different people. But the songs are so personal, and there are so many memories attached to each one. You know, and including Mr. Sinatra, who was extremely kind to me. And I can be quite emotional, and that's something I have to watch on stage just for the sake of the audience.
Well, it comes out in your songwriting. It's that ability to be in the moment with your emotions, I think, that makes your song so powerful.
Well, thank you. You know, I'm very, very lucky. I'm a kid who prayed. I actually prayed for God to let me grow up. When I was 14, I was driving a tractor out in the middle of a wheat field in the panhandle of Oklahoma. It was an International Harvester tractor, and I was plowing the wheat under so they could plant some more wheat. It was this limitless horizon, flat as a pool table out there for 50 miles. And I had my little transistor radio swinging from my umbrella on my tractor, and I'm driving along. And I hear this guy come on and saying, I go, who is that? And at the end of the time, they said, brand new record by Glenn Campbell on Crest Records, you know. Turn around, look at me. And I stopped that tractor and went home, borrowed the car, and drove to Beaver, Oklahoma, which was 22 miles away. They had a record store there. and bought Turn Around, Look at Me by Glen Campbell. And that night I got down on my knees by my bed. This is a true story. And I prayed to God. I said, please, Lord, let me write a song just half as good as Turn Around, Look at Me. And if it's not too much to ask, let me meet Glen Campbell. Now, this was a prayer that I lofted, you know, in the general direction of heaven when I was 14 years old. When I was 19 years old, I had a hit record with By the Time I Get to Phoenix. So it took 5 years to get from the wide open spaces of nowhere to Hollywood to the place where Glen Campbell was, and to get the song to him in the biggest crapshoot of all time, which is the record business, and turn my card over and see Glen's picture on it and watch that record go to, you know, the top of the charts. There's something about it, all of it, that is just, it was unreal at the time. Sometimes I still wake up and think, oh, this is odd. I'm going out tonight and I'm going to play for a bunch of really nice people. I'm going to play my songs. And now I'm, you know, now I'm not as young as I used to be. I've written a lot of songs. But somehow or other, I got from the panhandle of Oklahoma to that first record with Glen Campbell. And I think that prayer was answered.
I was going to say, somebody was listening.
Yeah.
And we are all so fortunate that that happened.
Well, you're so kind.
It's only the truth. It is only the truth.
So
I mean,
much.
Looking at the list of your songs, like I said, so many of the bands and musicians and people that I cared about, and, you know, music was so important, as it is for so many kids. You know, it's a way to kind of express the stuff you have no words for yet, you have no understanding of yet. And we are lucky.
Yes, and I just like to add to that. I think it's at the time when your emotions are at their most intense, and you seem somehow unable to articulate any of it, and it's just overpowering. And in my case, it came out as music. So in a way, it was your release as a listener to hear the music, but it was really my release to write the music.
Well, and now to perform it, and we are so looking forward to having you here on the PAP stage. It is going to be fantastic to hear you in concert, Mr. Jimmy Webb. It has been such an honor talking with you.
Thank you so much.
Jimmy Webb performs Thursday night at the Pabst Theater. There is more information at WUWM.com. And as Jimmy Webb performs All I Know for us, we wrap up today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.
Too easily to let it show I love you, and it's all